Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's podcast, we're going to talk to A.C. Grayling, who's a philosopher and author of a book called Who Owns the Moon? He's going to be asking what happens when companies and countries start exploiting the moon. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Before we get into that, if you'd like to comment on the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us, we're at Newstalk Science. And it's customary now to start off the show by looking back at some of the week's science news. And joining me to discuss is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from the DCU's School of Chemical Sciences, Dr. Susan Kelleher. Ruth, our first story, and I'm sorry, it seems like all the stories I give you are like bad news about the environment and your face just crumples as you're delivering them, but this one is about ice.
This is to do with Arctic sea ice specifically, so not the sort of glaciers on land that are made from fresh water, but sea ice when it freezes. And we know that that happens seasonally in the Arctic. You know, there's more ice there in the winter and it retreats a little bit in the summer. But this is a new analysis that was just published in Nature Reviews Earth and Environment, and it comes from a team in Boulder, Colorado. And they've re-looked at all of the data and they're looking at satellite imagery that, you know, that's been taken in the Arctic for decades now. And they are saying we are likely to see ice-free oceans in the Arctic much sooner than we thought we were going to. So they've looked at that data again and they think we could see the first ice-free day possibly in the next few years. And that's, you know, maybe 4 to 18 years earlier than we thought that was going to happen, but also that we will see the first ice-free month. And that's likely to be September because that's the month where there is the smallest amount of ice in the Arctic. We're likely to see that happening, you know, kind of by mid-century. And they are talking about potentially under the worst emissions scenarios that we would have an ice-free Arctic for much of the year by the end of the century.
What are the implications of something like that?
So the implications are huge. I mean, one thing is that ice provides a buffer for kind of erosion and waves and things. So when that is gone, we could see more dramatic impacts of erosion in the Arctic, which will have knock-on effects. I mean, of course, as the water warms with less ice, we're going to see different species moving in to the area. That's going to displace native species. So we will see ecosystems change. But unfortunately, and they have been a bit of the bellwether for Arctic change, this is likely to have a huge impact on polar bears. I mean, they depend on sea ice to hunt. That is how they get out to their prey. So if we have huge swathes of the year where there is no sea ice, they just will not be able to hunt at all. And it is a bit of a death knell for polar bears if we're under the worst scenarios here. So that is the bad news, I guess. I mean, the good news, I suppose, here is that, you know, we do still have a chance. Like, I know we keep saying this, we like have this toenail sort of clippings chance to still make things right. Sorry, that's a bad phrase. Or, I don't know, a hair's breadth to make things right. Yeah. You know, just the very edge of a chance to make things right. And the good thing about sea ice is it can reform again very quickly because, of course, it does. Every year we lose huge amounts of sea ice and then it refreezes again. Mm. So under the most positive scenarios, we can still stop this and we can expect to see sea ice coming back quite quickly if we manage to keep temperatures down.
This is also the week that we learned that if the Gulf Stream loses a bit of power, we could see Ireland facing minus 15 degree winters. So like there is, I mean, if we didn't need any more alarm bells, like I can't hear from the alarm bells that are ringing. This is, I suppose, another story that will go down in the signs were there.
Maybe the annals of I told you so.
Yeah. Susan, not unrelated, this melting of ice has other implications.
It does. And this is fascinating because I learned a lot reading about this. So this is a story about a report that came out recently from the US Government Accountability Office, who keep the government in check. And they look at suggestions that the US Committee on the Environment and Public Works needs to take. And that is around dealing with nuclear waste pollution that was created during the Cold War by the Americans. And it looks at contamination from US actions across three locations outside of the US. The first is Greenland, which is under the remit of Denmark, where contamination occurred between 1959 and 1967, where there was a military base there that was used to test ballistic missiles.
In Greenland,
an American base. And what they had was basically they had a nuclear reactor there, a mini portable nuclear reactor, and they used it. And then they just put the waste under the ice in an ice sheet, in the ice sheet. And that is a problem. The second is in the Republic of the Marshall Islands, where the US conducted 67 nuclear weapons tests between 1946 and 1958. And the waste was there, all collected onto one island and sort of covered with a dome of concrete and left to... It'll be fine. And then the third was in southern Spain, where this is fascinating. In 1966, in a town called Palermo, there were two US defense aircraft carrying four thermonuclear bombs that collided midair. Now, there was no nuclear explosion, but the radioactive decay was scattered all across this town. There was a cleanup done, but there still remains contamination and concern. So these are the three sites of interest outside of the US where there is...
That they're able to talk about that because they're public. About
in, very publicly, actually. I mean, this is available to read. It's a 26-page document. You can get into it if you want, but it's fascinating because they're trying to basically... The organisation that was looking at this basically had to come up with recommendations as to what should be done around this. And one problem is the effect of climate change on two of the sites in particular. So in Greenland, where the ice is melting and there's a risk of the radioactive waste being exposed and released. And then secondly, in the Marshall Islands, where increasing sea levels may ultimately have an effect on the concrete that's covering the waste that they've placed there. And maybe...
Right. Near people.
Near people, okay. Yeah. I mean, they're not living on that particular island where the mound of concrete is, but there's a lot of discourse in Spain and in Greenland and on the Marshall Islands where the people who live there and the governments of those countries are pretty unhappy with some of these things.
You would be.
You would be, this is true, but the report says that in Greenland, this report basically concluded that the site in Greenland was probably okay till 2100, so what are we saying that? You'd even
yeah,
that
I think
yet?
So, 2100.
2100. Say, yeah. In Spain, there's no agreement yet, but the levels are above that that's tolerated in the EU, but there's still no sort of, they have to discuss it. And then finally, in the Marshall Islands, they basically don't think there's as big a problem as the local people think there is, but... I mean,
they would say that. They're not there.
So yeah, it's exactly. Fascinating. Very interesting. Yeah,
but on the geopolitical thing about the ice melting, the other thing is that there's huge amounts of oil and gas reserves under the ice that's now going to become available. And you're going to have countries maybe competing for that. So, I mean, that's another issue. And of course, the trade routes, because the Arctic Ocean connects Russia, the US and Europe, which is where you get 90% of world trade. So there's an awful lot of exposure once this ice melts in lots of different ways.
There's a treaty, I think, that exists mid, I think, 2050 or thereabouts that will run out that prevents drilling. I can't remember where it is, the Arctic or the Antarctic, but it's... But yeah, they reckon once that's gone, it's going to be gung-ho for the polls. So very interesting and terrifying in equal measure. Ruth, some good news, I suppose. Scientists are growing mini organs from fetal cells. It seems like we have a lot of these scientists growing cells out of stuff. What is this story about?
Yeah, well, this is work from University College London and Great Ormond Street Hospital, and it was published in Nature Medicine this week. And the researchers here looked at the amniotic fluid, so the fluid that bathes the fetus during pregnancy, and there was 12 women and they were having routine tests during their pregnancy. And what they found was that there were cells in this amniotic fluid, as you'd expect, and again, most of them were just dead floating cells, as you'd expect, but there were actually stem cells. And what they did is they took these little stem cells and they put them inside a little sort of drop of gel, and they found that they continued to develop as the organ where they came from. So they were able to grow bits of lung cell, bits of kidney cell, bits of liver, and they call these organoids. So they're not growing into a full organ, but they are certainly taking on some of the characteristics of the organ from which they were shed during the development process or in this amniotic fluid. And they did look at some babies that went on to have a particular congenital condition where their diaphragm doesn't fully form. And they were able to look at the little organoids that they made prior to treatment that were taken from the pregnancy and after the treatment. And they were able to pick up a difference there. Now, they don't fully understand why that is, but it does make this a bit more interesting because it's a way to potentially keep an eye on fetal development and at interventions that are now more commonly happening kind of in utero when we can, you know, have technology now to pick up genetic conditions more easily. So something like cystic fibrosis. And if we ultimately do have therapies to go in and you know, use things like CRISPR, where we might be able to fix broken genes in utero eventually. This is a way where we can check and see what's going on without touching the fetus at all.
So the idea would be you would harvest from an amniotic sample, an amniotic fluid sample, harmless for the most part. You would take the fluid, you would then separate out these stem cells, and you'd hold on to them in case you needed to do experiments to see what might be going on with a fetus without interfering with the fetus.
Yeah, I mean, that's one option. I mean, the other option is that you just actually keep some of the tissue for that person later if they need it. You know, you might be able to, for a healthy fetus, you might be able to have stores, you know, in tiny amounts of stem cells for them, for their liver, for their heart, you know, for their lungs.
That you could implant and hopefully...
Potentially, you could do something with those later, yeah.
The idea is with these stem cells is that they, once they get the signals from tissues and fluids around them, they start often behaving like those... Yeah. The cells around them, that's the idea.
That's kind of the holy grail for some of bioengineering. You know, can we make absolutely human organs to replace, you know, the desperate need for when people have organ failure, rather than going to humanized organs in pigs or something like that. So I think the fact that we can access these stem cells without interfering in any major way with the fetus is a big breakthrough here.
Can I ask, how do they find stem cells? I mean, I often hear these stories of, well, we got this one neutrino or we got this one cell. How on earth do you find a handful of stem cells in what surely must be quite a relatively large number of cells from the sample?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think high throughput biomedicine, we're very much in the era of that now. So we have equipment that can sort into individual cells, and then obviously we culture them and we see which ones grow. So you know, a lot of time you're just getting rid of the ones that don't. So it's kind of a trial and error screening process.
Very interesting. Our final story, Susan, is a setback for the prospect of life on Europa.
On Europa, yes. So Europa is one of the moons of Jupiter, and it's believed to have ice and water underneath the surface, which is implies then there might be life under there. And how this is analysed is by orbiters that fly by. And so Galileo, Ruth?
Galileo.
Lovely.
Thank you.
With the orbiter that flew by, it flew by from basically 1995 to 2002, Galileo orbited. It orbited Jupiter and it flew by Europa and it was able to detect a little bit of oxygen and hydrogen in the atmosphere. But it did it from a bit of a distance. And so from that, it was kind of decided it was analysed and determined how much water might be under the surface and therefore how successful life might be under the surface in the icy or in the oceans under the surface.
And they thought it was loads, right?
And they thought it was loads.
Like just a whole bucket full of water.
They just thought, exactly. And they thought there was loads of potential for life down there. But now Juno, which kicked off in 2022, So Juno basically has now made it over to Jupiter and it's swinging around there and it has flown by Europa and it has gotten a lot closer. So it's only 353 kilometres from the surface and it has done much more, we think, more accurate resolution analysis of the atmosphere. It uses mass spec basically to do it. And the amount of oxygen there is not as much as we thought. So it's around the amount being produced per second is between 6 and 18 kilograms a second. Previous estimates were around 1,100. So it's considerably less. So, I mean, it just means that the amount of water that's there from which the oxygen comes from that we're detecting on the mass spec, I was involved, but you know, humanity.
Well, the fact that you're using terms like swinging around, it makes me think you're not a planetary scientist, but that's fine.
It's okay. But it does mean that there's a lot less maybe water there than we originally thought. And it could still be a place for, you know, habitable life, maybe a different kind of life that we know. I mean, there is oxygen and hydrogen there, which means probably water there, but how thriving with life it is.
Don't book the holiday yet.
We won't know for some time because until we get down there to drill in an Armageddon style fashion, it'll be unknown.
Yeah, very good. Don't bring the Lilos. Dr. Susan Kelleher and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland, thank you very much. Now, on December 1st, 1959, 12 countries signed the Antarctic Treaty, committing to conduct themselves in a spirit of peace and scientific cooperation in this frontier territory. God, it sounds like such an innocent time, doesn't it? But 3 months earlier, an even newer frontier had been crossed as Luna 2 became the first spacecraft to reach the surface of the moon. And yet, almost 65 years later, there's no treaty for the moon. Why is that? And who owns the moon? That's the question Professor A.C. Grayling, philosopher and author of Who Owns the Moon, is trying to find out. He joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Anthony. So take me back to this Antarctic treaty, because it's a good sort of analogy, I suppose, because it's sort of dead man's land, the moon and the Antarctic at the time. They were sort of grey spaces that hadn't really been ventured. What does a treaty say, and is the idea or the language, is all that applicable to the moon today?
Well, the Antarctic Treaty, which interestingly is not a UN treaty, it was a treaty really encouraged into existence by the United States and the USSR, who were a little anxious about the prospect of the other party there using the Antarctic for nuclear weapons testing or for claiming sovereignty over it. Now, it happens that prior to that time, a number of nations did indeed claim sovereignty over parts of the Antarctic. And what happened was that the treaty parties decided that they would park these sovereignty claims, put them to one side, and what they would do is they would agree to keep the Antarctic pristine, just for scientific research, no commercial exploitation, no pollution, and so on. And it's very often held up, this treaty, as a kind of paradigm of a successful international treaty. And one thing, unfortunately, because this is very relevant to the moon question, is that that treaty is rather badly fraying at the edges.
Right.
So even though it is said to be a paradigm of what a good treaty would look like, it rings some alarm bells.
And before we go into the alarm bells, this idea that you can just stick a flag and claim something is yours, when did that end? Because you said these countries claimed sovereignty over the Antarctic. I mean, we were still doing it as late as the 20th century, where we're still saying, that's my land and here's why.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And indeed, it was precisely because the flag planters were quarrelling with one another over where they had planted their flags that there was this need for a treaty. I mean, as I suggested there, it's a Cold War treaty. You know, the US and the USSR were bristling at one another. They had a problem in the Arctic, where the USSR and the US actually had very close borders. And so what they were seeking to do was, around the margins of the Cold War tensions, anything that could have an unexpected triggering effect, they wanted to set to one side. And so they did that with the Antarctic, and then they went on to do it with the moon itself. Because in 1967, a United Nations treaty came into existence, a very minimal and really rather in its terms, feeble treaty, called the Outer Space Treaty, with specific reference to the moon, and tried to make the moon a kind of Antarctic, with one very big difference. And that very big difference is that whereas the Antarctic was treated as a domain purely for scientific research, cooperation, peaceful activity, the moon was restricted from having nuclear testing or weapons on it, or any indeed militarization, but it was designated as a kind of Wild West, free for all. Anybody who can get there can do what they like there, other than things military.
Oh.
And this is the point now, which is coming into focus.
I see, because the focus was on conflict rather than exploitation of resources. And this is something that a number of companies and countries are very, very interested in, which just, I suppose, surprises me in a way, given how expensive it is to bring stuff to and bring stuff back from the moon. Elon Musk's success in splitting the cost of sending stuff to space in 10 aside, it is still very expensive to get stuff up there. And even to launch from the moon is a challenge that we haven't yet. Yet this is an area of extreme interest to a number of countries and industries.
Indeed, indeed. So Japan, China, India, and the United States of America in a somewhat different way, because Japan, China, and India are state actors involved here. It's state money, government money, which is going into this. But in the United States of America, NASA is now really encouraging and supporting and promoting private enterprise. Indeed, the Odysseus lander a couple of weeks ago was a private endeavor commissioned by NASA to go to the moon. Now, here's the thing. Over the last 25, 30 years, hundreds of billions of dollars have been invested by private parties wanting to get to the moon because there are valuable resources there. and they want to get a return from this huge investment they've put into it. So it's happened already. We're all living in the future here already on this front. And all the lunar landings which you've seen in the last couple of years, most of them having problems and some falling over and some blowing up and so on, all of those difficulties are really just steps towards success, because from every failure, things are learned. And with this degree of investment in the enterprise, it is inevitable that both the technology, the cost of doing it, ways of doing it, and the determination to get it done means that there will be commercial activity on the moon in the very, very foreseeable future.
Really? And what's up there that's of such interest that we haven't got in abundance down here?
Well, you know, on Earth, there are very rare and diminishing supplies of essential elements required for all our modern technologies. You know, so when we think about our laptops and mobile phones and computers and AI and all the rest of it, they require some very, very difficult to get resources, and they are on the moon. And so they're also, by the way, at the bottom of the sea, some of them. So there's another question there too. But on the moon, in addition to those mineral resources, there's also water ice, especially at the South Pole and in the deep craters. And water ice is a very valuable commodity from the point of view of space activity, because it can be separated into hydrogen and oxygen and used for rocket fuel.
Yeah.
And indeed, it's now more than 20 years ago that one of the private companies in the US aiming to get onto the moon and get hold of that water ice and turn it into rocket fuel in order to provide, well, be like a petrol station in space, you know, for all the activity to and from the moon, and also for further exploration to Mars and beyond.
Right.
So, you know, when we talk about these hundreds of billions of dollars that have been invested, these guys are not, you know, complete idiots. They really are looking for some return on that investment.
But Wayne, I mean, to me, knowing what we know about, even just, we've done a number of programs just on space dust and how difficult it is just to land and get machinery working on the moon. It just seems like such a long journey, such a long marathon of a commercial endeavor. I'm just really surprised that people are putting their billions behind this particular horse. What about just leaving the moon the way it is? What about having a ban on all commercial activity on the moon? Is that possible?
Well, let me come to that point in just one little second. First, I just want to say that the kind of attitude which says, oh, it's all so difficult and so expensive. Mm. Well, that's probably what people thought when they were looking at the Wright brothers, flopping about in their first little heavier-than-air aeroplane.
Mm.
So you can see, especially if you take into account the rapidity of technological development and change in our world. I mean, dizzying when you think just of the last, you know, two decades. That these problems, the technology and cost problems, will very soon not be problems.
Mm.
And when you think about the lithium and beryllium and the zirconium and uranium and thorium and the rare earths and the water ice up there on the moon, it's just too tempting. And those problems will be overcome. Now, there is an upside to this. You see, don't you think it might be better to mine on the moon than on Earth, because there's much less risk of pollution and damage to an environment on the moon? The technologies which are being developed to do it will, like most technologies, have big spin-offs. I mean, who now remembers that your Teflon frying pan is, in fact, the result of rocket science, you know, of Apollo going to the moon?
Yeah.
There are all sorts of benefits that might come, and not just technological benefits or economic ones. There are also benefits to our imagining, to our perspectives, to our thinking about art and philosophy, to the view that we take of ourselves here on Earth. You will remember those very first photographs of Earth from the moon, that beautiful little blue object hanging in space. Well, the more familiar we become with that external perspective on the planet, the more people will, I hope and expect, will think, firstly, that's our home, got to look after it. Mm. We're all one family on it, you know. There might be some positive differences to make. The point of my book about this is not you know, really to dig into all the positives, because there are some, as I say, but to look at the worst case scenario, which is that with all these hundreds of billions of pounds invested, and not least by private agencies, the risk of competition, rivalry, turning into conflict, which has a blowback on Earth, that is the really serious risk. And the point is that the 1967 Outer Space Treaty is utterly inadequate to manage and provide a framework for those possibilities.
So if we were to have a new treaty, what should it say?
Well, you know, all treaties are only observed by the parties to them, so long as it's in their interest to do it. Mm. And we know that, you know, money and power and status eventually come to trump people's promises and commitments and so on. So, you know, one can't be over-optimistic or idealistic about this. But a really robust, very thorough, solid treaty, which is as enforceable as it can be, which provides remedies for bad actors doing bad things out there in space, you know, like interfering with other people's activities, let's say, maybe even a space court where disputes can be resolved.
That is something I would watch on TV for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it won't be perfect and it won't be ideal and it won't work in every case, obviously, but it will impose a certain degree of restraint and responsibility. Because after all, you know, most states and even indeed most corporations, if you've got lots of money invested in something, you don't want there to be a war getting in the way of you making a profit. So people could be restrained by it. And that is the aim.
Yeah, I kind of feel like it would just make everything a bit more clandestine. I mean, if we look at, you know, the weaponization of space and how people signed up to that treaty, I mean, do we really think that there are no weapons currently in space? I mean,
There are loads. Yeah. There are loads already, because in the very congested, crowded orbital zone around our own planet, you know, with all these constellations of satellites that speak to one another in order to determine our GPS location, all the military surveillance and communication satellites up there, already it's the case that the major agencies operative in space now regard space as what the United States a military manual describes as a war-fighting zone. Mm. I mean, it's really quite incredible in a way. It seems like a joke, but it's no joke. You know, under President Trump, when he was in office, a fourth arm of the U.S. military was set up called the Space Force. It's called the Space Force. And the members of it, you know, like in the Marines, the soldiers are called Marines, and in the Navy, they're called sailors and so on. Well, in the Space Force, they are called Guardians. And the uniforms they wear, I kid you not, I mean, you can go on the internet and look for yourself, the uniforms they wear are straight out of Marvel Comics.
Yeah. I know. And it immediately spawned a sitcom because it was such a preposterous idea. But yeah. There's no question that that treaty isn't being adhered to. It'll be interesting to see if any treaty comes about and what will happen with it. But it's a really interesting read. Who Owns the Moon is the book by Professor A.C. Grayling. Who Owns the Moon? In Defense of Humanity's Common Interest in Space. Anthony, thanks very much for your time.
Our great pleasure. Thanks for talking to you.
Thank you.
I reckon there's very little chance there are not more than just satellites up there. I reckon there's space lasers. Aidan McCulvey, our producer, joins us to go through some of your comments last week. Like, isn't it really naive to think that there are no actual physical weapons in space at this stage?
Yeah, I don't want to misrepresent A.C. Grayling, but he did say that more or less in our research call. I'm pretty sure he was like, yeah, I think there are more weapons up there.
Right, he mentioned in the interview that he was like, sure, there were satellites and stuff and positioning. I totally get that, but I would be very surprised if the Americans or the Chinese haven't figured out some sort of weapon that can fire from space. Certainly, I suppose the state of drones at the moment, you probably don't even need that. But anyway, I think if I was Trump and I thought the way Trump was, I would totally go and get myself some space lasers. Right.
That's a hard mind frame to put yourself in.
If he created the Space Force, I think that he's also capable of wanting space lasers. How are you anyway? How are things?
Yeah, very, very good. Back working on the show properly, loving it. Yeah.
Yeah, we've had some good features the last few weeks.
True. Yeah. We have, yeah.
Yeah. And this one, I really like this one about the moon. We also had a really good one last week with Dr. Matthew Campbell on brain fog. And we got some comments in from you. Martina texted in saying, I have and I'm still suffering with brain fog since having a problem with my parathyroid gland, which caused the gland to take too much calcium from my bones. When my blood was tested, high levels of calcium were found in my blood and I was put on calcinate to replace the calcium that my bones were losing. The brain fog is now not as severe as it was. It's as if my brain is not firing on all cylinders. The gland thought to be causing the problem was removed in an operation. God, Martina, that must be awful. I mean, you know, we take our body integrity for granted, you know, and we often really sympathize with those who've lost their legs and or arms or limbs or any sort of functionality. But on an equal footing must be losing your sharpness in that way.
Yeah, I think it would be so difficult. I have a sort of a acquaintance, a friend of a friend who has chronic fatigue, and it's just so debilitating. Like, he's a lovely fellow, but he just struggles to do, like, anything that we do that's normal, it's a struggle for him. It must be just so difficult to kind of lose, as you said, that sharpness.
Yeah, I had some back injury a while back, and I've been trying to get back to sport. And for a long time, I felt like someone's been just turning down all of the power in all of my body parts. And I kind of feel like that must be kind of what it's like to have brain fog, where you know you can do more, you know it should be better than this, but you're really frustrated that you can't get what you want out of the thing in question, in this case, Martina's brain. Sorry to hear about that, Martina, that's awful. LCD Lou texted in. He or she said, patients in Ireland are getting no benefit from any of the research completed in Ireland. The 6 long COVID clinics do not have the technology for the testing needed. As a result, patients are continuing to decline. We need doctors to speak up for us. What testing do you mean, LCD Lou? Because testing for these things, I mean, obviously this long COVID thing is now testable, as we heard, with a biomarker, but what other testing is required? I'd actually like to know more about that. Do you know, Aidan?
No, Matthew kind of suggested that this, as you said, that this was kind of the first biomarker. Like, I think it's sort of, it's cutting edge, and long COVID is so poorly understood at this point that I don't know how much testing they had up until this point. Like, that's the great kind of, that's the great thing about this research, that now they will be able to test it more effectively. So certainly, I'm sure the testing isn't fantastic, but I feel like that's possibly just the nature of like a new illness. They're still sort of kind of rumbling around in the dark, trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. But maybe she or he means more research. Philip emailed us in. We were talking about Cass Sunstein's book, Look Again, which is talking about habituation and how we get used to pretty much anything if we're exposed to it for long enough. And we got this email in from Philip. He says, I'm nearing 75 and I've had glaucoma for about 10 years now, which is apparently accelerated glaucoma. I'm sorry to hear that, Philip. The sight in my right eye is currently about 50 and I have about 10% in my left eye. I can no longer read, drive, write or watch fast moving TV. I leave the lights off at night when I get up to get used to possible blindness in the future. Gosh. Doctors tell me it won't happen, but the rate of deterioration suggests otherwise. It has upsides, though. I don't get asked to do shopping, decorate, or do DIY anymore. I get sympathy from some people. I still play par 3 golf, watch my friends. My friends watch my ball and tell me lies about where it went. Very good. I'm still playing golf. That's incredible. These friends with my wife and my daughter drive me everywhere I need to go. For the past 25 years or more, I've lived with chronic testicular pain, diagnosis of vasectomy gone wrong. So I'm expected to hear different diagnoses in the next few weeks. Oh, God, Philip, you've had a tough run of it. This is not so easy to ignore. I can imagine, and that's one of the things Cass said, is that pain is not so easy to tolerate. In the case of glaucoma, I hope to get fitted with a wooden overcoat before I go blind. What is that, Aidan? Is that a reference to something that I don't
know? No, I think that's just a joke. I think he's just making a joke. Sure.
In other words, making so it doesn't bang into stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Slow. I brain fog myself this morning. I listen to a lot of podcasts and you and your colleagues are right up there in my favorites list. Keep up the good work. Well, Philip, thank you so much for listening. Really do appreciate it. And keep battling on with the golf. I'm really impressed by that. And don't forget that you don't need 100% perfect 20/20 vision to listen to the podcast. Laura says, my input, I moved to South Africa 9 years ago. When I arrived, I felt so trapped and contained by the burglar guards on windows and doors, the security estates and the extra security precautions. Yeah, so South Africa, obviously, for reasons of safety, if you are living in Cape Town or surrounding areas, there's a huge amount of extra security because of levels of violence and attacks, unfortunately. And she says, now it's become second nature and the norm, to the extent that when I go home to Ireland, I have an awareness of the lack of security that was never there before. I never charted how long that habituation process took, but we're moving home for good next year, so I can chart how long it takes to get let the guard down again, so to speak. Kind regards, Laura. Well, don't let it down too much, Laura. As a victim of a burglary not so long ago, a little bit of caution is always advisable.
Yeah, it is a different world though. In South Africa, I was there a few months back, and it's just it's the most unsafe I've ever felt anywhere in the world. And I'm lucky enough to have gotten to a lot of different countries, and it's a totally different feeling. Like there might be nothing particularly untoward happening, but you have that constant base level of like anxiety. And it struck me as a person visiting something very hard to get used to. But naturally enough, everybody living in South Africa was used to it for years. And I had heard also anecdotally, that's the kind of what Laura said there, that South Africans who came to Europe were kind of weirded out by the fact that you could just walk anywhere. Because you couldn't walk anywhere in South Africa. And even like Cape Town isn't like the eastern part of the country over near Johannesburg is like way worse again. It's just a very strange and kind of regrettable way to have to live your life. And we're very lucky in that regard here, that you can just walk out your door and walk to wherever you want to go, and for the most part not really worry too much about your safety.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your comments and emails. We do love hearing them, and if you have anything you'd like to say on what we've talked about here or weaponizing the moon, let us know. You can email us science@newstalk.com. That's it from us on this week's program though. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, Simon Keane, Steve Daunt and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.